Well, welcome back, and it's time for you to become part of the program. We'll take your calls with Charles Kappas as we talk about how we are going to handle the financial mess we're in now with this coronavirus, and will we rebound? Let's get your thoughts on that and your questions when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Charles Kappas with us. Charles, did you ever think in your financial career that we would face a situation like this where the economy would get roughed up from some kind of a pandemic?
No, not a black swan event so much. I just thought it was going to be finally the markets rolled over. There could be a collapse in the banking system. Bond market could go no bid. Or, for example, we know that Deutsche Bank right now, one of the biggest banks, most systemically important bank, according to the IMF, is probably having liquidity problems.
Oh, geez.
And the repo crisis has preceded the virus by 5 months. In other words, by about September of last year. So the Fed has intervened, and roughly $10 trillion has been siphoned off there to the major crony big banks, and without any accountability, hardly any discussion about it. But that just shows you there's a liquidity crisis out there. So this was preceding it. The virus just made it worse because it shut down the velocity of money that the economy, 70% of that economy. So we were long overdue for the business cycle, boom bust cycle. And I, you know, but at least if a guy lost his job, he could go out to the bar and cry in his beer, you know.
You can't even do that now.
Can't even do that. So, no, I this has been pretty severe, the biggest downturn, fastest and hardest. And I don't see any really recovery. Everything's pretty much being held together by one thing, and that's confidence, George.
Yes,
confidence.
I agree.
You know, and that's going to be eroded very much.
What about bricks and mortar stores when things get back to normal? I keep saying when things get back to normal. I hope they do. But what about bricks and mortar stores now that so many people are accustomed to shopping at home online?
Well, that's a new trend, isn't it? I mean, maybe even working from home. So these are things that are going to be, one thing is going to lead to the other. Maybe some of these businesses just should have gone under anyway. Maybe your town didn't need 50 Mexican, you know, restaurants or something. There was overcapacity out there. And you know, the free market, you should have allow it to clear. You know, free market capitalism is the shareholders took the risk, like at Boeing. You know, they took the risk with their management. Why do they need a bailout from us, the taxpayers? Why does Illinois need it and the pensions? And that's a whole other matter. I wrote my book over the concern of the demographics of the baby boomers. You know, I'm 68, and the unfunded liabilities are somewhere around $200 trillion. And 10,000 baby boomers are retiring each day. So that's a whole other. That's on an unsustainable path, right? And then the public pensions are probably about $5 trillion in debt right now. Illinois is, of course, in the worst shape. They're trying to exploit the virus to get bailouts, which is pretty insidious. But there's other states. I mean, Kentucky and New Jersey and California and so on. A lot of mismanagement there. So that to me, looked to me a more certain reckoning day. I mean, a trillion dollars is 12 zeros. I mean,
that's a lot of zeros.
I mean, we have notional value of derivatives somewhere around $500 trillion. You just can't get your head around these figures anymore. I mean, we're just throwing money around. It took until 1980 our country hit our first $1 trillion under Reagan. And you know, now we just do it in weeks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what's it up to now, total?
What's that?
Well, what's our total debt up to?
Well, I think it's 24 trillion, but that doesn't count GSEs like Fannie Mae and underwriting national mortgages and
student loans and all that stuff.
Bailouts and the 10 trillion we don't even know about. There's a missing $21 trillion, according to Mark Skidmore and Catherine Austin Fitz. I don't know if you've heard her talk about
that. Oh, yeah, she comes on quite a bit.
Yeah, exactly. $21 trillion just missing through the DOD and, you know, HUD and so on.
Yep, they took it.
Trillion.
Let's go to the phones. Daniela in Cupertino, California. Welcome to the program. Hi, Daniel.
Hi, Charles. Hi, George. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure thing.
Say, along the lines of George's remark about was this an anti-Trump move by China to sour the economy, I think there's a little teeth to that because at the very first opportunity, the very first conference they held with Trump after this thing broke out in late January, a Chinese reporter woman stood up and said defiantly that Chinese people are resentful about where this may have come from. And then immediately her next remark was, and will this affect our trade talks or our negotiating talks? In other words, the way I took it, it was like, Trump, you're too tough on us at the negotiating table, so take this. Now are you going to treat us better?
Mm-hmm.
And in the very beginning of Trump's presidency, I remember the leader of China saying, scoffingly, America will never be great again. So I do think there's something to what George says. What do you think?
Well, that's, we've had a tense relationship with China, and trade wars don't help things because they say if goods and services don't cross borders, then armies do, and we you know, this rhetoric. So if this was a pathogen that had asymmetrical warfare usage being used for, designed for, then that is something that they would want to exploit your weakness. Sun Tzu, one of the ancient writers in China, said there was different strategies, you know, long-term strategies with the Chinese have. But I think, like, your first guess there, George, tonight, was that this was an accident that leaked out and it spread like that, and that's why they tried to cover it up. What they're trying to make it a more partisan issue here in the U.S., that's because we're in election year, so that's what you can expect.
Isn't it interesting, Charles, that all those problems in Hong Kong with the demonstrators has simply vanished since this virus popped out?
In Hong Kong?
Yeah.
Yeah, no one's talking about that. They pretty much smashed that down, I understand, and without any kind of coverage and things like that. So the virus has helped, you know, kind of cover up that issue over there.
It sure did.
You know, China has long said that they want a de-Americanized world. And they have they have writings about asymmetrical warfare. There's a book called Unrestricted Warfare and how to take down your opponent and so on. So it could be an EMP. I mean, Donald Trump just passed an EO for strengthening against an EMP attack. What are they seeing in the intelligence agencies? Because that's clearly asymmetrical warfare with China.
Well, there's no question about that. It's just a disaster. And, you know, we have funded that Wuhan lab to the tune of $3.7 million. And also we were going to be funding them again through the National Institutes of Health. And the president stopped that. That's ludicrous. I mean, what are the odds of funding a viral lab in Wuhan where this thing apparently started?
Yeah, I don't understand that. We should just get out of the UN anyway.
So. No coincidences. Let's go next to Joel in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Welcome to the program, Joel.
Hey, George. Good to speak to you again. Hi, Charles. How are you?
Oh, good.
I have a comment. I think the biggest problem with the China situation is that they shut down their own country domestically when they knew there was a problem, and then they let everyone else from Wuhan travel all over the world and infect everyone else, it seems, is what happened. But that's just a comment. That's not why I called.
Okay.
Charles, you mentioned the Bretton Woods system. And, you know, I understand after the Roman Empire collapsed, I think like between the 4th and 5th century, we went into feudalism, and that lasted until about the 17th century, and then capitalism came about. And in the beginning, I know that America used bimetallism, which was the real wealth of our country in the beginning. And in 1873, the bankers petitioned the government to demonetize silver, and this became known as the Crime of 73. Mm. And what it did was it removed silver's status as money. It instantly reduced the quantity of money people had to pay bills with, and farmers and small businesses were forced deep into debt, shifting wealth to the Eastern bankers. And this seems like, you know, how the central banking system actually began. And then we went into the, you know, after a while, we went into the Bretton Woods system after World War II, because we had the largest gold reserves and we were able to dictate the international monetary system. But then in the 60s, welfare warfare, it increased the number of dollars in circulation, and countries started to accelerate their exchange for gold, and the gold supply was being depleted. It went from around 20,000 tons to 8,000, and that's why Nixon ended the gold standard. And then we defaulted on our promise to back the dollar with gold, and that ended the Bretton Woods system. But and then in 1972 to 74, Nixon and Kissinger created the petrodollar system, and I haven't heard you elaborate on that. Saudi Arabia was chosen, I guess, because of their influence in OPEC, and then in exchange for the United States guaranteeing their survival of their regime, they would make sure all transactions in oil would be conducted in dollars. So the dollar status
Very
is basically
correct.
Just tied to oil, and that's it. So I don't know if you could comment on that. And if people started saying, look, we're not going to take dollars for oil, we want gold, what would that mean as well?
Very astute, Joel. What do you think, Charles?
Well, that's quite a good understanding there of the history, especially the Bretton Woods. And by metallism, which was a big deal about 100 years ago or more. So pretty familiar with that history. The Bretton Woods Agreement has broken down because they, you know, established the dollar as a reserve currency after World War II, and it was to be exchanged for $35 in gold. Gold was $35 an ounce. They tried to maintain that with the London Gold Pool in the 60s, as you might know, and it failed in 1968, and that's why they introduced the SDR in 69, and that's why Nixon... That even failed because the world needed more dollars because we were in the Vietnam War and so on. So we were inflating. Our biggest export is inflating and sending dollars around the world. So Nixon had to shut down the gold window and decoupled gold at that point. So we've had a floating currency ever since. And that's really the danger that we're up against, is because historically all fiat currencies eventually fail. And the petrodollar was devised about that same time with Kissinger. It was a stroke of genius in a way, because all crude oil contracts had to be denominated in dollars through the Saudi Arabia if we cut a deal with them to protect the royal family, which we've been doing ever since. So,
and that's what cooked Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein when they decided to get off it.
That's the whole cause belli, they call it. What's the reason? And that's why we went into Iraq in 2003 to bring back to end the euro being
used for the dollar.
Crude oil and euro, yeah. So to maintain the petrodollar, which has also, by the way, increased the amount of dollars or the need for dollars around the world, and why we've had a free ride about trade deficits, which has been caused because that we can just send dollars around the world and they have to hold those currency reserves, and they send us goods and services and we send them paper, pieces of paper.
Worthless money.
Worthless money. And those dollars offshore, by the way, are called euro dollars, not to be confused with the euro, but how after the Marshall Plan, dollars were needed to repair or rebuild the world in Europe, and so they just call them euro dollars. But that's unregulated by the Fed or anything, and that's a huge tranche of U.S. dollars that could come back to the homeland, just like it did in Germany in 1923. That would be a hyperinflationary event.
And, Charles, if the president called you and said, the coronavirus situation is almost over, we're bringing our businesses back, we're opening up again, but I want you, Charles Kappas, to fix this economy, what would you do? How would you start?
Well, we could start investigating the banks and their criminal activities. We should... I write about this in my book a little bit, about the monetary reform. The Glass-Steagall Act, you know, was repealed in 1999. We need to impose that again because they're taking risk with people's, you know, deposits.
Well, explain what that is for people.
The Glass-Steagall Act was imposed or passed in 1933, and it wanted to separate banks from taking risky investment, risking people's deposits in risky assets.
On high speculative investments, right.
And so they wanted to separate that. And it worked fine for 66 years. And under pressure, under Clinton and all his cronies, the bankers conspired and had that repealed. And, of course, immediately afterward, we had the dot-com bubble and then the subprime and now this. And now you can be an unsecured creditor in the banking system because they're talking about bank bail-ins like Cyprus and Greece, not bailouts, mind you. The Dodd-Frank doesn't allow that. So I would lower your exposure to the banks.
Keeping it under that FDIC minimum, I guess.
It's what?
Keep it under the FDIC minimum.
Well, that's kind of meaningless. It's not even insurance, so I don't think there's enough there to cover that. But that's when they passed the FDIC. It was in 1934. It's interesting you bring up the crime of 1873 because in 1900, the allegory of the Wizard of Oz was that Dorothy originally had silver slippers. Do you know that?
I heard about that. Then who turned them into ruby slippers?
They did in 1939 because the movie new technology was to have color movies, and so they made them ruby, and that
they wanted them to really sparkle. Sure.
Yeah, it destroyed the whole meaning because the yellow brick road represented the gold standard, leading to the Emerald City, which is green for money, of course, and OZ is the abbreviation for ounce of gold. And Dorothy was depicted as the average American, little bumpkin from Kansas. Scarecrow was the farmers, the Tin Man was labor, and she had the silver slippers. And the new Technicolor technology destroyed that. And it represented the free silver movement, which he spoke of, and the crime of 1873 when they just pulled out. The farmers, they wanted a silver bimetallic standard because the farmers wanted the U.S. Mint to make silver plentiful, valued at 16-1 to help lift them out of poverty and enslavement to the bankers. And, of course, in the end, she throws water on the witch, and that's liquidity, which always had the power.
And you think these were the real meanings behind the movie?
Yeah, you can go to the Secret of Oz. That's a website, I think. Bill Still talked about it. Rather fascinating.
The writers must have been geniuses for what they did.
Well, he hid that. He was a Democrat, and he was careful to politically tone it down a little bit. And
by making it a very fun type movie.
Yeah, because it was made a movie in 1939. He wrote that in 1900.
Who did the Munchkins represent? Us?
The Munchkins was the little people.
Yeah.
The William Jennings Bryan, he took up the silver cause. He was depicted as the cowardly lion. And then William McKinley finally defeated him and demonetized silver, and that's when they took it out. The Gold Act of 1900 was signed with a gold pen. I think it's insidious that they did that. So we need to assert silver. Right now, the silver-to-gold ratio is 100, 110 to 1. It should be 15 to 1. That's
yeah, it's a huge buy right now. It's a great buy, I think.
Well, it's undervalued. It's the most undervalued asset in the world. And I think gold and the SDR component to restore confidence, they're going to have to reprice gold to $20,000. Jim Rickards talked about this, others. In 1980, you had the Dow to gold ratio was 1 to 1. It was 800 points and $800 gold. Why not $23,000 gold today? That's what I say.
Follow the yellow brick road, Charles.
Amen. Well, I want the silver slippers.
I love that. It was a great movie, too. It really was.
Well, of course, that's the meaning behind it.
The scene I always hated, though, was the witch when she was up in the house and the Twister was carrying her away and the little witch would go by on her broom with that cackle.
Cackle, yeah.
Who did the witch represent?
The Wicked Witch of the West was Rockefeller, the Rockefeller interest.
Really?
They wanted the slippers, and after the Wicked Witch of the East was killed, that was J.P. Morgan, but we're never told why the slippers were so powerful.
Wow. Well, as a kid, I never would have understood this, believe me. We're going to come back and take final calls with you in a moment, Charles, on Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, the psychic lawyer Mark Anthony joins us, and he will do readings in the latter part of the program, so make sure your dial is right where it is. We're going to be back in a moment with final calls with Charles Coppice as well. And welcome back to Coast to Coast. Charles Coppice with us. Charles, do you still advocate IRA accounts and things like that, or should people just hold on to their cash?
I can help people put those qualified plans into precious metals, and I'm glad you brought that up. It's pretty extreme demand for gold and silver right now. And I help people with physical delivery. I got some deep sources. A lot of places around the country you can't get it. The U.S. Mint's closed down. Canadian Mint's had trouble. So it's getting pretty scarce. And yet at the same time, I can do the depository accounts and then IRA accounts into physical gold and silver. Fees are very low. It's all on my website. But the price, I'm always asked, why is the price so low? Why is this happening? You have crude oil, overcapacity and demand destruction, and they're paying you to take it away from them. And yet we have extreme demand for gold and silver, and the supply sources are drying up, and yet the prices are trending lower or staying down below even the cost of production. And so something's obviously up here, and I think it's now for the whole world to see. We could be facing delivery defaults at the supply line.
Wow, that's unprecedented.
At COMEX now, things like that, just like Nixon defaulted in 71. So it happens, and they're trying to suppress the paper price because they created COMEX as a paper futures trading market for commercial speculators and commercial banks. And those are usually the big Wall Street banks up there, the primary dealers like J.P. Morgan. Interesting how J.P. has now acquired 900 million physical ounces of silver. They didn't have an ounce of silver in 2011. And then that's when they started acquiring it on the cheap. And they're the main commercial short at COMEX. We call it CRIMEX.
Do they have physical possession of that?
It's estimated that they do have that much because they're the custodian for the SLV and others. So here we are, you know, at 100-to-1 ratio or worse, and it should be 15, 30-to-1. I could see silver going to $150, $300 an ounce, and that's mostly, funding IRAs and stuff, I would put it mostly in silver and then some gold, but, you know, it's the most undervalued asset in the world. I think it has nowhere to go but up, and we could be just weeks away, perhaps, from
an explosion like
really
that.
Really blowing it out, yeah, because demand is just going to overtake it. It's pretty extreme. Again, money should be a store of value, and it's not. So that's going to be in my next newsletter. You know, I put out a monthly newsletter. People can sign up for that at my website, either website, name and address. And I'm going to address that straight on. I think that's the big story going forward because they hate gold and silver is like kryptonite to the bankers. And yet they've been, you know, net buyers of gold since 2010. You've never seen that. And last year they even passed the Basel III Accord, requiring these GSIB huge banks and central banks to have move gold to a tier one asset. I think they see a time where they're going to have to recapitalize the failed banks. And I've heard prices of $20,000-$30,000. And again, why not if the Dow ratio was 1-to-1 in 1980? So that needs to be addressed. I think we've been waiting for this for many years to see this happen. And one thing to restore confidence in the global monetary system is they're going to have to put gold back into it. The Gold Act of 1900, again, they demonetized, took silver out finally in 1964. So silver is still money. I mean, J.P. Morgan, why would they have that much? If we get $50 silver, which we've had before, that their annual revenue is only $34 billion. They'd make $50 billion or more. So I can see... you know, don't follow what they say. Do, you know, follow what they do.
Exactly. Let's go to Thomas in La Jolla, California. Tom, go ahead.
George, thank you for taking my call. And thank you, Joel, for the great question. That was very, thank you.
That was
and
good.
Charles, thank you for what you do. My favorite Wizard of Oz character was Toto the dog. And it was Toto that exposed what was behind the curtain.
Yeah.
Anyway, Charles,
that's a great scene. I remember.
Oh, yeah, it's a beautiful scene.
That's the Fed behind the curtain there, by the way.
Yeah. And then comment and then a question. In 1913, very rapidly, Congress passed the Federal Reserve Act, and then they also passed the federal income tax, which I felt it was connected, and Paul Warburg became the head of the Federal Reserve in the United States. His brother, Max Warburg, became the head of the German Central Bank in Germany. You might say that world central banking was a family affair. And, of course, we ended up monetizing World War I. 50 years later, 1963. And if you, Charles, you, George, and I, Thomas, are old enough to remember silver certificates.
Yep.
And that's when a dollar bill, you could redeem it in silver. And then John F. Kennedy, in the summer of 1963, started issuing from the Treasury, not Federal Reserve notes, but Treasury bills. And they were specifically $2 bills. And, of course, then came November 22, 1963, and they say that every president since then is given a 60-second video by the Federal Reserve, and it's called the Zapruder film. But, and, you know, if you go back to those newspapers of November 22, 1963, it's amazing what you could buy, you know, like a luxury car or a home with a two-car garage, you know, and land around it, that type of thing. Everything was so cheap. So anyway, I was wondering, Charles, if you would comment, is there a connection between the 1913 Federal Reserve Act, the federal income tax? I mean, we used to monetize the government by tariffs, is my understanding.
Yeah.
And, of course, the taking away of silver as the backing of our paper currency in 1964, as you pointed out. Anyway, any elaboration on that, I would appreciate it.
You bet. You must be reading my book.
I bet he is.
Well, that's all covered concisely as G. Edward Griffin in his great book, The Creature from Jekyll Island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've had that wonderful man on your show.
Good guy.
And it's quite a history. Of course, I went through a lot of that to make a concise statement in my book. Well, anyway, 1913 was really, and that was after the 1907 bank panic, which they had created. And this almost goes back to the Wizard of Oz in that period, Jennings Bryan. They created panics in 1893 and so on. They were driving for the Gold Act, and then finally they put together the Monetary Commission with Nelson Aldrich. Paul Warburg was in the middle of all that as well, and they created the Glass-Owen bill. That's what it was called back then, the Federal Reserve Act bill. So it finally became law in 1913, but notice that was in December on a Christmas break on a nearly empty floor. Everybody's anxious to get home. You know how they do it.
Oh, yeah.
And they just pulled it on it. Because in February of that same year, that's when they passed the 16th Amendment. They had to get that in place first to contract the money supply. Your taxes don't go to pay taxes. They're destroyed because if the federal government can just create money, as we are seeing, then why even have taxes? It's to contract the money supply. That's by Beardsley Rummel. That's in my book. He was and he was the one that brought about the victory tax in 1943. You know, just a temporary thing for a couple of years. Well, that's become permanent now, the withholding tax, and that's what they want to contract your money. So they had to get the means of contracting before they could get the Federal Reserve Act later, and they did. I forget the guy who wrote the book, Chertoff, I think, the Revolution of 1913, because it really did change America, internationalism, and especially that. But they also, in April, passed the 17th Amendment, which made direct election of senators instead of being appointed by the legislators to protect or represent states' rights. So states' rights have been pretty much ruined, and the Senate is unconstitutionally seated, in my opinion. D.B. Kidd brings that up.
Interesting.
That's what they did. That's the three big things they did in 1913. So we've been stuck with it ever since. And think about it. It took 800 years, or it took 95 years until 2008, and the Federal Reserve had a balance sheet of $800 billion in mostly AAA Treasury bonds.
Let's go to John in Oregon now. Hi, John. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I got three things I want to say here.
All right.
Number one, in Oregon, the governor, Brown, has extended the closing date to July the 6th.
Oh, my God.
We got people here in Oregon, especially on the Oregon coast, that depend on the tourist industry is going to bankrupt the state. The second thing is I used to sit around as a young boy and listen to my grandfather talk about the Depression and everything. And so, he went and he was going to buy a tractor, and my grandmother said, no, you know you're not. And he went to the bank, drew out the money. The next day, the stock market crashed, and he had all this money. He ended up buying half of the town at the end of the Depression and everything else. But I went out and bought about in 2007, I bought about 1,800 ounces of gold at $737 an ounce.
You made some money on that, John.
And anyway, I went yesterday and I figured this out about our national debt. To put this into perspective, if you spend or pay to the national debt every second, $1, it will take you 800,000 years to pay off the national debt. They say, make America great. America is bankrupt. We need to get people in our government that will start paying down this debt. At the end of the tunnel here of this pandemic, we're not going to come out of this. I hate to say this. I hate to be the barrel of bad news, but we're going into a depression. And it's going to be 1,000, you think it's bad now, it's going to be 1,000 times worse than it is right now.
Let's get Charles's comments as the clock is ticking. What do you think of his comments, Charles?
Well, I certainly agree. We should quit, avoiding using the word depression if we're starting to break all the metrics that line up to that, the velocity of money and things like that. We can never repay the debt. There's two ways to destroy a nation, said James Madison, either through the sword or through debt. And the debt is going to do us in. And that's why the Federal Reserve, created in 1913, has come full circle now. It was almost a suicide pact because the power to print money is too great. Article 1, Section 110 in the Constitution says we should only have gold and silver as legal tender. And so we've been fooled what money is. And now they can just create it at will, and it's going to eventually hyperinflate. Don't think it can't happen. And so you either pay down the debt or you default on it. And I think that's what they're planning to roll out, is a solution to the settlement currency of the world. And the U.S. dollar is going to be taken down in that regard as a basket currency within an international settlement currency, which I think will have a gold component. I write about that in my book. So how the debts get repudiated and written down, I'm not sure, but usually it's just striking off the zeros and starting over.
Let's go to Greg in Dumont, New Jersey. Squeeze you in here, Gregory. Go ahead.
Morning, guys. Real quick thing about one of the founding criminals, if you will. The first panic, the first depression in our country was 1792, right here in New Jersey. It was called the Society of Useful Manufacturers, the Ponzi Scheme, and the architect, he's on your $10 bill, folks, Alexander Hamilton.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been forever. Charles, back on September 17th, the Bank of International Settlements in Basel, guy there said to the financial communities, stop doing this insanity. There'll be a meltdown sometime in the next year or so.
Right.
Absolutely. Here we are. You didn't need the coronavirus. My question to you is, since you mentioned repo before, on March 20th, $1 trillion was put into the repo world, $500 billion in the morning, $500 billion in the evening, for several days. This is all going to hedge fund criminals, Wall Street criminals, speculators. They're not building any bridges. They're not building any hospitals, right?
They're not.
They're hoarding the cash. We're almost out of time. Charles, quick reaction.
Well, nobody's tracking this or bringing it up. There is a website called WallStreetOnParade.com, and you should see their daily a chronicle of this, and I think it was Thomas Malun, a professor in Germany, who said, when historians look back, when the great financial reckoning, monetary system breakdown, occurred, it will be September 17th, 2019. That was 5 months before the virus even hit the U.S.
That's a lot. Charles, thanks again for being on the program. Look forward to your news inserts on the program as well. His book, America's Financial Reckoning Day, his websites are linked up at coasttocoastam.com. Hey, by the way, the deadline's coming up quickly. If you did not file a tax return last year and have children under 17, you must act now to get the $500 economic impact payment per child. There's a lot of people out there that can use that money right now. Make sure you get it done by May 5th. We're running out of time to get your payment in 2020. Go to irs.gov. That's irs.gov. Enter your information in the non-filer tool by the end of May 5th.